Hello and welcome to The Shape of Work, a podcast series by SpringWorks. My name is Anoop and I am your host. Each week, we'll be talking to top people managers across the world on the future of work and how it's shaping our workplace. So sit back and get ready to find out more from these movers and shakers as we have a no-holds-barred, anything-goes conversation with them about their journey, their insights, their thoughts, and most importantly, their ideas and vision for the workplace of the future. Join in on the conversation, leave a comment, and don't forget to hit that subscribe button.
On this episode of the Shape of Work podcast, SpringWorks product manager Nisarg Shah talks to Ryan Gomley, head of people and culture at Nylas. Ryan is infatuated by innovation, perseverance, and change. Ryan is a strong believer in diversity and loves to innovate. His previous stints include working for organizations like Slack, Symantec, and Airnin. He is a startup advocate who loves to build things. On the episode, Ryan shares a few experiences and ideas on keeping up with the forced transformation in how team leaders should train, manage their remote staff, implement work-life balance within the workspace, and rethink HR policies.
Hey, Ryan. Thank you so much for joining us on the Shape of Work podcast. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Nisarg. How are you?
Lovely.
Excellent. Thanks again for inviting me along and being part of this journey. It's great to be here.
Of course. So Ryan, why don't you take us through what your journey has been so far in the HR world?
At Nylas, yeah, absolutely. So now, currently I'm head of people and culture at Nylas. It's an API company or startup based in San Francisco, the Bay Area, but growing at a tremendous rate. Year-over-year growth, I think, is right now at 75%. Huge expansion, not only in the United States, but Toronto, so Canada, now Vancouver, and then making our way over to Europe. My role, since I joined, I pretty much took over the role. I had to build up a team from one to now, we're currently six, and we're going to hire another five here in the next 3 months. So that's great news. My role encompasses everything from recruiting, employee engagement, compensation, performance reviews, performance management, benefits, you name it. Everything under the sun is part of what I and my team takes care of. And it's been an absolute incredible ride over these last 11 months being at Nylas. It's just not only the experience and being part of this incredible journey, but also the people I get to work with. The co-founders, Gleb and Spang, incredible human beings. And then you look at the executive staff, Lou Salfi, David Ting, and all the directors and managers, as well as all the employees. What we've been able to achieve in 11 months, or for the organization over the last 7 years, is just admirable. So
that's great. So we'd also love to know about how your journey has been since you started out in the HR space and what it has been so far.
So when you say HR space, like my entire past or just the focus? Yeah. All right. Fair enough. So let's wind it back about a decade ago where I was still in Vancouver, originally from Vancouver, British Columbia, and wrapping up my degree at Simon Fraser University in business. And from there, I was moving down to the States, ended up in California and joined Electronic Arts, where I joined the talent acquisition group as a program operations analyst, focusing on systems, backend analysis, metrics, things like that. It was an incredible experience, learned a lot, did that for 3 years. The gaming world is just remarkable. It's really fascinating to be a part of. Went up to the East Coast because my wife was out there doing her medical residency in Baltimore. So joined Bethesda, ZeniMax Media. And was there not a whole lot of time spent at Bethesda because when I joined, they had conducted a hiring freeze. Not the best time to join a company.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, they had to do layoffs. It was part of that. But the good thing is I was able to join a solar startup that had been acquired by an energy firm in Houston. And so they asked me to come in and help out when it came to the people HR side of things. Helping out with the systems backend, integration with the acquirer, because you know you're gonna have an overlap of system and processes and try and blend them in together. So that was a great experience. But at the same time, I was also pursuing and eyeing to go back to school to get my MBA, which I did at the University of Maryland, Smith School of Business. Did the 2-year full-time program. It was one of the best experiences of my life. A lot of people always ask me, like, when you walk away from that experience, what was it that defined it? To me, everyone's going to have a different story of why they're doing it and why they're going. For me, it was the opportunity to learn more, especially on the financial side. Because when you get an MBA, it's quantitative work at a high level. So it makes you think about things differently. And so I give a lot of credit to the program for building out a strong curriculum when it came to entrepreneurship, but also the analytics piece and then the leadership component. Those are the three that I kind of went after and pursued. Focused a lot of my time on entrepreneurship and finance, because I feel like if I was coming back, I wanted to learn something different, something that I kind of always avoided in my career, which was analytics and the numbers. You can't find success if you don't know numbers. Someone told me once, the number one language in the world is numbers. So from there, great experience, did an internship with Symantec in the Bay Area. I was very fortunate for that. They asked me to return full-time employee, so I did. And it was, they were trying to figure out, you know, where I was going to end up. The compensation, global team needed more help, more resources, so I joined that. And that was an incredible experience. That's where I truly was able to build out my knowledge and understanding of compensation at a very high level, working with all sorts of departments, sales, engineering, product all over the world. Also M&A, a lot of acquisitions came through. So that was a great experience to be a part of. And then from there, I just realized I had a mentor actually there by the name of Eric. And he would say to me, if you're going to live apart from your fiance, what is the end game? What's the goal here? Because if you're going to be in the Bay Area, you should be working for an organization you want to be a part of and really grow at a very high level. Because I think he could see that I wasn't getting everything I felt like I needed at that point in my career. And he was right. I've always wanted to work for startups. When I was in my MBA program, people flat out told me, like, you're either going to join a startup or you're going to start a startup. And they're right. I live for startups. I love it. I'm a big advocate for everything about startups. I find you can grow at a faster pace. You can learn a lot about yourself. The ideas that come at the forefront. And it's very much like, that sounds great. Launch it. See what happens. Test it and reiterate. And all the startup books you can think of, The Lean Startup, Hard Things About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. I think that's the number one book every single person in the startup world has to read. Ben Horowitz does a fantastic job outlining how to think of a startup, how we're all built for different stages. It all depends where we're at in our careers and what are we looking for. So from there, I realized that my mentor was right. I needed to go somewhere else to gain more experience at a faster pace. And so I was fortunate enough to join Slack. And Slack was probably one of the most pivotal moments in my career. And what I mean by that is I joined at a time where they kept saying during the interview process, we're not going public, we're not going public. And then day one, we're going public in 6 months. And I was like, oh my God, like, this is crazy. Wow. So that part was very unique. I think the part about Slack was when a company's going, and this is advice to anyone that's listening to this, that's thinking about a startup, you have to be very methodical of when you're picking a startup to join. A startup that's going public in the next 12 months is not, in my opinion, is more of a established organization. They've already hit that inflection point. That's why they're going public. If you want to be nuts and bolts, motivated about working around the clock, join a series A, B, C, or D. That's where you're going to come in. You're going to be able to make a heavy impact. Personally speaking, I think series A's and B's, that's where it's a lot of thrashing. You're trying to figure things out. You don't know where this is going yet, but it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of stress. There's a lot of highs and there's a lot of lows, but you'll walk away with a better understanding of how to add value and understand how velocity works and is needed in a startup. So with Slack, even though the culture was fantastic, the people I was engaging with. I worked with a lot of the recruiting department about offers and how to think about compensation and equity. Learned more in that in those 9 or 10 months than I probably had in the previous 5 years of my working career, because wow. I was dialed in. You were there from, on the computer from 7 to midnight. So it was a lot of work, and no one told me I had to do it, but I wanted to do it. And with that, I was able to learn at a very high pace and high rate. The unfortunate thing was my wife was now in Denver, and they just opened an office in Denver, and I wanted to go to Denver, but the team wasn't ready to have us spread out, dispersed in different locations. I know we're going to get into that, the whole remote hybrid piece. So realizing they were going public and realizing that it was a hot market, I was getting opportunities to consider other startups. I decided to depart. I think also the other piece I want to highlight is one of the directors and I just weren't clicking, and that's going to happen. And I like to talk about it because I think we don't talk about it enough, where when you are in an organization, you have to be okay with the culture, with your team, with the people you report to. If you're unhappy with any aspect of those three, you're not going to last long. And you're going to realize that I'm not happy. I have to make a change in order to prove my happiness. And so I always, now in the position as head of people, I always say, people do not join and leave companies based on benefits, based on compensation. There's a baseline. They join because they can have the opportunity to work for an organization they admire. That's really important. An industry they're passionate about. I don't belong in oil and gas. I don't belong, but I belong in like SaaS, B2B. That stuff is really fascinating to me. I'm really intrigued. APIs, love that stuff. So it's really important to understand where your interests lie. Regardless if you're in the people or HR world, if you're in marketing, if you're in engineering, you have to be passionate about the industry and the product that it is you're building and you're part of. And then with that, I would say is you have to feel good about the value add that you're going to bring to the organization and the people you're going to work with. That's what determines people's success, and that determines when people join or depart organizations. So from there, I got an opportunity to join a fintech, and the fintech was fabulous. Learned a lot. Was head of compensation there, Series C startup in Palo Alto. With that experience, I was brought in by the VP, Jermaine. Fantastic leader. We were ripping it. We were headed for Series D at some point. COVID happened. And with COVID, even I saw it a month before. My wife's in the medical field, where she was saying, like, this is really bad. Like, this is going to impact all aspects of society. And I relayed this information to the CFO, as well as the VP of people, to say, you're not only going to have to do a hiring freeze, you're going to have to do more than that. Because earning what their business model was based on, getting paid for the work you do the day you do it. Mm. And the model was based on, there was no service fees or percentages they took. It was a tipping model. So it was a brilliant idea what Rom has created over there. But imagine when everyone's being laid off, they have no work to go to. So they don't need that money interchanging. And with that, they're not tipping. And so it was a domino effect, as we all saw. So I helped a little bit and understood exactly what was going to take place. And part of that was trimming back the organization. So I was part of that. I think it was about 35% that were laid off a year ago. But I do believe one chapter closes for another to begin. Mm-hmm. And I was very fortunate a month later to speak to Peter DiMarzio, the chief of staff at Nylens, about the head of people role. So I know it took probably a little longer than you wanted, but that's the journey for over the last 10 years, decade.
This has been amazing. We can go on this for probably 10 hours, pick each and every experience. This was lovely. This has been, that's some great experience you've had. So, with the pandemic coming in, let's jump right into it. It changed things across the world, how companies operate, how they think about employees and people and culture. So what in your opinion has changed? Do things go back to normal? What things go back to normal and what things don't? And like what has been the impact of the pandemic on HR?
Yeah, great question, Israr. So they go back to normal, define normal. I always say to my team or people, define normalcy. What is normality? Yeah, you know, like, I mean, it's just like when someone's like, well, it has to be perfect. Perfect in whose eyes and mindset? So to answer that question, pre-pandemic, pre-COVID, I was always a big believer in giving more freedom and autonomy to employees to do their work. This whole mentality that we have an office and we need people in the office, to me, that is, you're not treating your employees like adults. You're micromanaging them in a direct or indirect way. So that's part one. And then part two is, with offices, even though they do have some value where they bring people together, I would argue that the cost benefit analysis of office space does not make sense, especially for startups. I would argue you can have office space, but you need to think about what is it going to be utilized for? What is the intent behind having office space? So going back to the office and this, all this talk is, it's either A or B. It can be A and B. You can have office space. And Microsoft's done a great research report on this about the hybrid world that we're moving towards. And I'm a big believer on it, that we're all adults at work, so we should be held at the high standard, like Netflix or Amazon does with their employees, is we expect the best of the best. We build high-performing teams. And so if that means that you're going to have find more success, you know, working from San Diego or Montana or New York City, do you, you know, where you are, when you work, you know, like there's a lot of people that have other things going on in their lives. Rather than sitting in a commute for an hour in the Bay Area, that time can be spent waking up, knocking some things out, taking your kids to school, you know, going to a doctor's appointment. There should be no shame on people changing up the days as long as they're getting the work done. And at Nihilist, that's something we believe in, is output-focused mindset. The inputs, we're not really concerned about, because you're an adult. We trust you. You come in. We're trusting you, because that's the other value we have, is trust. We're trusting that you're going to do everything you can to set up Nihilist for success. And if that means that you need to change your schedule to deal with other, you do you. Whatever you need is totally fine for us. And so I guess what I'm highlighting here is there's a lot of intangible benefits. And it's about the work philosophy that we offer, rather than what kind of video games, or do we have beer in the fridge, or the reason I go to the office is because, you know, they have a barista. That people don't join and leave companies based on that. They join in and leave companies based on the work culture. Some look, in the end, I always say to people, we're all going to come and go, because especially a startup, 2 years equates to like 6 years at Google. You know, you're constantly on the clock and working hard, that you're just going to get to a point that after 2, 3, 4 years at a startup, you're probably going to move on and try something different. Why? Because there's been so many changes at that startup over that time that it becomes hard to identify where you belong anymore. But the work remote, the hybrid, well, there's two things I want to touch on about the hybrid piece, is that there's a lot of talk about where work versus office, and it's kind of separate. It's very much of, if you have a startup, where do you want people to be? Well, I have office space in two major cities, New York and San Francisco. Great. So you have office space. Is there an expectation for those people to be there on a regular cadence? And I think that's where it gets a little muddled. It's a little confusing. There's remote, hiring an engineer in North Dakota that is you hired that person because you wanted that skill set. You're not going to put an office in North Dakota. But with New York and San Francisco, you have office space. Now there's a second piece to this argument or discussion, is regardless if you're remote or you're near an office, are you giving the employees autonomy to decide what to do with their day? That is the discussion we need to be focusing on. That's what's going to attract talent. That's what's going to retain talent, is giving them freedom to decide how to structure their days. And I'm a big believer with the value of trust that we have at Nihilus. You cannot have any micromanagers in place. I do not believe in micromanagers. I find micromanagers disrupt the well-being of the culture and individual performance behavior. They don't add value to them. They don't help grow and develop. And so for that, I believe if you're going to have a value of trust, no micromanagers, because you're indicating, I have nothing but full confidence in everything you do, which is why we give you the autonomy we do to get the work done. So I know it's a bit of all over the place, but to sum up, remote is separate from office. You're going to have some people that you're going to put in certain cities all over the world. There's certain startups that are purely remote, you know, like Twitter and Slack are more or less shifting to that. Like, you know, we don't expect it. But at the same time, I think there's startups that are looking at it. And I think that's where we're headed, because we're remote first, office second. Is we're still going to have some office space where people can go and interact, but we don't need 5,000 square feet. You know, we probably need 1,000 square feet, probably utilize a lot of shared space, you know, WeWorks. To fulfill that need and requirement. And again, it goes back to don't double down on office space to think that's going to define your culture, because it's not. Leadership defines culture.
And then there is also this other side of this argument, or probably not other side, but a fear that with hybrid models coming in, right, that even when you give the autonomy to the employees to decide whether you want to come to the office or not, irrespective of the location, there is this fear that this might create two class of employees, right? One who show up in the office space, and the leadership also shows up there, and they get more FaceTime with the leadership, and they are more over there, they feel more involved with the culture. And then the remote employees, there's a real big challenge in terms of engagement. How do you engage remote employees? How do you make them part of the culture? So that is something that really needs to be solved for. And, you know, like what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, that's valid. I think, but let's talk about it. For example, Nihilus has offices in San Francisco. I'm talking to you today from Denver, also New York City, where we have a contingent of people that we gave up our space because of COVID, but we're going to go and get space in the near future. Toronto, London, Amsterdam at the moment. So those are the major cities that we're focused on. Now we have employees scattered in certain, like Seattle, Boston, Austin, Houston, Chicago. But if I'm here, like for example, the CRO for Nihilus is also in Denver, and I can go in the office from time to time and meet with them, or I don't. So I can have FaceTime if I choose to, if I'm in the same location, but there's still employees in other locations that the CRO still needs to connect with, and he can't do it on a personal level. Mm-hmm. So I think that FaceTime piece is almost a barrier and excuse to justify for people being in the office, when really, big picture, you have a workforce that's scattered everywhere. So I get it. Someone in San Francisco could go to the office and interact with, say, the CTO or the senior VP of engineering, but there's other engineers in Toronto that they can't. So what
do
is
you think,
the discussion?
Do you think it would create an additional pressure on employees who are remote to choose to come to the office?
Yeah, and I think that's a great question. I think that comes down to, again, leadership. Hmm. There's some CEOs out there that are really big on getting everyone back in the office. Reed Hastings from Netflix has stated that, like, he believes it's really important to our survival and our existence. I get it. It's not to say right or wrong. I'm a big believer of, if you're going to have office space, you should have freedom to decide when to go and how to go and what to do with your time. So, for example, those times in Denver, I'll go to the office. Will I be there full day? There's times I'll be there early in the morning, late in the evening. There's times I only go in for 2 hours. And no employee should be judged. Their performance should not be judged on whether or not they were in the office. And that's an old school mentality that if Stacy wasn't in the office, Stacy's not performing. I disagree with that. That's completely incorrect. It's the output. Did Stacy hit deadlines? Did Stacy add value? Was there impact? Was there velocity? Is she pushing the needle forward? Yes. Leave Stacy alone, because Stacy, not everyone can work and function at a high rate in office. There's too many distractions. There's a lot of side chatter. Every time when I go in, everyone wants to connect and chat. I don't get anything done. And then I have to come back and I'm exhausted. So I believe the discussion needs to be focused on understanding and accepting how there's all sorts of types of employees that need different work environments, and to accept that and be okay with that.
Makes sense. Another thing with remote work is the life, you know, the line basically between work and life kind of gets blurred, right? You don't know where the work time ends, where you know your personal life starts. So how do you think managers and leaders should think about work-life balance?
Yeah, that's a good one. I've read a lot of the research on this, where they talk about the work-life balance, work-life enhancement, different terms, different concepts. So there's a couple things that I believe in. There's a couple things that we've already implemented pre my time at Nihilus that I think are fantastic. I think in the end, there needs to be more guidance and encouragement from leaders, from directors and managers, to ensure that people's well-being is still being looked after, that they are setting boundaries. So that's one thing as head of people that I'm really pushing for, is encouraging the employee population to set boundaries and to understand to say how to say no. So that's part one. And also encouraging leadership as well as management that you only can ask for so much for so long. And then you're trying to figure out, well, why is everyone burnt out, or why are people, you know, contemplating about leaving? And understand and appreciate, well, because they can't turn things off. And I think there's two things to understand here. One, the pandemic really threw a curve into everything, because no one, if you took time off, where were you going to go? And that was a thing that we were noticing at Nihilus, and even at Earnin before I joined Nihilus, was, okay, you told me to get offline. What do I do? Like, you know, to play more video games, to read another book, to, I can't go anywhere. I can't go see my family. I can't travel. So I think that really impacted a lot of people to think, well, I'm here, so I might as well keep doing it. And so that was a unique situation that hopefully things continue to trend in the right direction, that things will improve when it comes to work-life balance and making sure that when things open up, people can get out and go do things, be a part of society again. So it's part one. And then part two is, even post-COVID, is accepting that you got to set boundaries and you have to take time off and you have to really embrace your own personal life and what it has to offer rather than work, because the work's not going anywhere. So I think that comes to, again, leadership, advocating for people to not burn out, to take the time off. And so, for example, at Nihilus, before my time, when I arrived, they created a policy where every 6 months, it's a little confusing, but long story short, you start at Nihilus. After you complete 6 months, you're required to take 2 weeks consecutively off. Now, with COVID, some people have been like, well, what am I going to do with these 2 weeks? So it's been a unique situation. But imagine post-COVID, where people can't go around and move around and travel. You do your 6 months, 2 weeks off. And then when I entered into the organization, I made it clear that we should be expecting people to take 4 weeks off a year. One, we have unlimited PTO, but you hear a lot of startups that offer that, but they don't really encourage it. We strongly encourage it at Nihilus, because if you don't, again, it goes back to the burnout piece. Everyone's already working at a tremendous amount, a tremendous speed. they need to be able to turn it off, and they're not going to unless you really kind of push them to. So there's those two, is that pretty much every 6 months you're taking time off, and it's strongly encouraged. And then also we did research on holidays, and there's two things about holidays, is that I always looked at it and thought, oh, that's interesting, is how a company can be based in the United States but have offices all over the world, but there's other countries that have more liberal holiday policies. So in the end, when you look at the average total of number of holidays in the United States on aggregate compared to other countries, it's quite low. And so I remember looking at that and working with other individuals and thinking, well, that's kind of unfair. You know, Canada or Asia or Europe, they have more than the United States. And so we did research and we agreed that we would make sure, one, to talk to other companies to figure out what they were offering. And on average, out of 15 different tech companies, it was something like 10 and a half days a year. And then also we looked at what mattered to us and what days were really important. And then we looked at what was the standard across the globe. If we're operating in the UK or Europe or Canada, what were the expectations when it came to mandatory holidays? And so we agreed that moving forward, we're going to have one figure, 14 holidays a year, that everyone gets, regardless of country or location, because we're talking about, you know, equality and equity. Well, that's another aspect that should be applied to this, is the number of time off, the number of holidays one individual gets in one location versus another individual in another location.
Nope, absolutely. Makes sense. Another piece of remote I wanted to touch on before we move on is compensation, right? So location used to, or probably some places still is, kind of a major part of compensation. Compensation varies based on location. Now with, so many companies adopting remote, you get access to talent from across the world. So how should HR leaders think of compensation now, since there is more access to talent and, you know, everybody's used to be compensated based on location, but now there is no such criteria?
Yeah. I could literally talk your ear off for the next week about compensation. I don't know how we're going to get through this. That's a great question. All right. So compensation, pre-COVID, you know, you had more or less, from my experiences of working in other organizations, depending what country you were talking about, so smaller countries, you would just have one national figure that you would use for certain roles. Where United States, India, China, I'm trying to think, even parts of Europe, you would sometimes break it out in geos. With compensation now and with the whole hybrid workforce, I just want to go back to that for a second before we dive into the comp piece, is that
sure.
I think a lot of companies, there's going to be a real shift here where Microsoft, Twitter, Slack, you know, a lot of those other ones, including ourselves, Nihilus, are heading in the right direction, in my opinion, where they're giving people the option and the choice. You do that, you have more loyalty, you have better retention rates. And people will probably, and the research is out there, and I know for a fact it will, people will value the work flexibility and the hybrid work. I come and go as I choose, or I can go work from Australia for a month or whatever. They'll value that more than pay increases at a large figure. And I know someone would say, well, how do you measure that and how do you analyze it? The big picture is pay only gets you to a point and then it kind of plateaus. What people then want is, oh, do I have more freedom to midday go to my daughter's soccer game or catch a flight to go to New Delhi, whatever it may be. And it's that flexibility piece that I think people are craving more for. So I do think that there's going to be this massive shift where you're going to see a lot of talent leaving organizations if they're forced to go back. So that's part one. I do believe that. I would not work for an organization that told me I had to be in the office every day, because I do not work well in that environment. I get more done at home in this office nook than I do at an office where there's numerous distractions and almost work becomes a second necessity or requirement. with the piece that I want to also touch on is how the compensation will slowly, compensation takes time, quarter over quarter, year over year, to shift. Mm-hmm. And because you had this massive pandemic where people are moving all over the place and it's really hard to understand what's going on, you're going to see a shift in it for sure. I do believe there is a lot of misunderstandings and misconceptions about compensation in general. People think about compensation of cost of living, and that's technically incorrect. It's cost of labor. It's the going market rate for the job you do in the location you do it. Hmm. It's to do with supply and demand of talent in a location. It's no different of lumber and milk and, you know, airplanes. We've all learned it, apples. So the supply and demand curve dictates what you get paid. And that means that if there's a shortage of jobs in a location, but there's a high demand for that skill set, pay will increase on that supply and demand curve. So for the Bay Area, sometimes it goes back and forth of, well, it's to do with the fact that it's the cost of living, that's why we're paid as much as we are. And it's like, no, that's incorrect. It's because there's so many tech companies, Netflix, Apple, Google, Facebook, Salesforce. I mean, I could go on and on. And those are the big juggernauts. And then you have Amazon, Microsoft, who aren't even headquartered there, but they have massive offices. They have all that talent there because they're looking for tech talent. So they're looking for those product managers. They're looking for those engineers. You go to that location, and that's what happens is there's just not enough people to fulfill the needs and the wants of the organization. So you start a bidding war for talent. So you see a slide up on the equilibrium of price of how much you're willing to pay for someone to get them to come in and join your organization. So I think that's number one, a fundamental about compensation is about cost of labor, not cost of living. When you move people to other cities and locations, what I think, and we do, I've done this at Slack, Earning It Now at Nihilist, where I take the time to explain compensation to employee populations so they have a better understanding how to think about it. When you are considering about moving people to different geos, I do believe there needs to be some sort of understanding of New York and San Francisco, expensive cities. They're at the top of the tier. They're equals. I don't believe cutting every single city or region up when it comes to compensation. One, it's too much work. And two, in the end, it's you're talking about apples to apples. The differential between pay between New York and San Francisco is minute for say, software engineer. So you bucket them, you bucket cities. And so the next tier would be Seattle, Los Angeles, Denver, Chicago, Austin. That'd be a tier two, where anyone living or moving in those cities, or you get an offer from anyone in those cities, that's what you would pay. And that would probably be roughly 15, 20% less than tier one, which is New York and San Francisco. And so with that, you have a better idea of how to pay people. I think it brings more, again, equality and parity to the table, equality and equity to the table, where you're saying to people, well, I'm not going to overpay for people the Bay Area rates for someone in Mobile, Alabama, because I can. You can, but remember, is that fair? Is that demonstrating a thought process of how you're treating comp? And on the flip side, well, what if you hired someone in, Montana? Should you be paying them Bay Area rates? There's some companies that are talking about doing that. I think Reddit's the latest one. I think there will be more of a shift towards that. I do believe that you start to muddle the waters if you're not treating compensation fairly across the board, mm-hmm. which is why I think there's that argument of, well, if I make Bay Area rate, I should be able to make that anywhere. And that's wishful thinking. Like, I agree, I would love that. But the going market rate for the job I do in Denver does not pay the same amount as it does in San Francisco, because there's less demand for my role here than there is in San Francisco.
But so with remote work coming in, right? So many companies adopting remote first and full remote.
Yes.
That changes the supply-demand equation. right? Mm-hmm. That mm-hmm. now, let's say I am a startup in San Francisco. I don't necessarily have to compete for talent in San Francisco. There is now this entire world that has opened up with remote coming in, and I can hire from any place. And then similarly, you know, companies like Spotify and Reddit, you know, as you mentioned, that they have opened up and said that wherever you work from, we are going to pay this flat salary, let's just pay area salary to everyone. And then it's on the person or on the employee whether they want to stay in Bay Area, they want to go to Thailand and, you know, live at like, you know, half the prices or half the living expense as in Bay Area. That's on the employee. Mm-hmm. So then, again, then that changes. And then I can understand what you were saying about the fact that people might not feel that they are compensated at an equal level. Right? A person who is in San Francisco and a person who is in Thailand, they are compensated equally. But then obviously, at, you know, in larger scheme of things, they are not.
Yep. No, I completely agree. And I think with remote, you are right. You're going to see a shift. It just takes time to see that shift and what the pay looks like. So you've heard of Mercer, you've heard of Radford, who specialize in compensation data. So that's going to be interesting how things unfold. But that takes time for those companies to collect that data from all the organizations. So that's part one. And part two, Facebook and Google, Salesforce, they're still going to have those offices in the Bay Area. It will take time to shift. And note too that I'm a big advocate on if someone works for Salesforce and is considered someone that is top talent, we need to retain this person, and they want to go move to North Carolina. Usually what happens, and I believe in this, is that the manager and the compensation team, they review the pay, they have a discussion, and more or less in the end, it's the manager's decision what to do. From my own point of view, so for at Nihilus, if a decision is to consider dropping the pay now to adopt or have that person fit into the pay band for that new location, no more than 15%. It should never be. So even if the market data is suggesting drop it by 35%, that's going to demotivate a human being. Why would you do that? So there's the yin and the yang. I always say it's going to hover around 10% if you drop it. There's been cases where we've had people move to other cities, and I've talked to the hiring manager about what their thoughts are. And I said, here's two options we can do. You can drop it now by 10% and let them know why, or don't do anything. And then when it comes to performance review cycle, just let them know now, hey, there's a good chance because you're now higher up in your pay band, you probably aren't going to see a pay increase. Or if you do, it's going to be very small. And it's all about transparency. Tell them fully what is it that's being decided, why it's been decided, and how things are going to function moving forward.
Yeah, what's the reasoning behind it?
Yes.
Makes sense? Awesome.
Yeah.
So I wanted to shift gears a little bit. So a lot of companies, but to start with, two who are in the forefront of this. One is Coinbase, and second is Basecamp. They recently announced, you know, that they're going mission driven. What is your thoughts? What is your opinion on, you know, these mission driven companies who have, you know, are out front and they have said that we do not want discussion around, you know, political ideologies, you know, non-profit organizations. We are a mission-driven company. We know what we want to do. We are a for-profit company, and this is what we are headed towards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. It definitely has opened up the whole discussion about what is appropriate when it comes to social and political discussions at work. There's also the other one, Shopify. Or the CEO, Toby, he wrote that open email. And his is slightly different compared to the other two. First and foremost, I do believe organizations have a due diligence to have a safe environment for employees and make sure that they do feel good coming to work, that they do feel happy. And happiness comes in different stages and formats. So there is that engagement piece that I think all organizations are required to do. I think there's that part where in today's world, there's so many social and political issues where it's tough for an organization to figure out where should we focus our attention? What can we say yes to? What can we say no to? And be okay with that decision. Nalis has been very, very open. Gleb and Spang have been very thoughtful about a lot of the social and political discussions or scenarios have gone on in the world or in the United States in the last 12, 18 months. With Coinbase and Basecamp, I think, well, first and foremost, every company, just like every human, you have your own culture, your own opinion. You can do you. I do believe there has to be a place where people have the ability to come and openly discuss. I think the problem right now, especially with tools like Slack, is you have a lot of chatter going on behind the scenes that ends up taking away from work or disrupting work. It's being very divisive where people can't focus enough on the mission that you talked about. So I think there has to be definitely engagement by the organization to take a stand, to talk about it. Insurrection in DC. I mean, that I think all organizations had to acknowledge that. That was a terrible thing that happened. That being said, I also think it's very important for leadership and organization, for the culture, to be transparent, but also for the employee population to understand that it's not a democratic society in the organization where we're going to vote on every decision. And I think that has something that's become a growing theme in organizations is, well, what about, are we going to discuss this? What about our, and it's like, well, we can discuss it, but it gets to a point where when does this discussion end? When, and I'm not saying like it has to end, but when can we table it and say, okay, we've heard from everyone. This was a great learning experience. There is no end or beginning. It's just now we need to move forward. It's a tough one because I think that's the problem is that you have various individuals coming from different perspectives, ethnicities, religious backgrounds, beliefs, philosophies, values, the political scene alone. And I think that's gotten to a point where there's certain groups or certain individuals, whether you work for a highly conservative organization or liberal organization, and you don't identify completely with everything, that you feel like you can't speak up. Well, that's not a safe environment. And the number one goal is to create a safe environment. So I do believe that things need to be acknowledged, need to be discussed at the forefront, always. But I do believe that sometimes some of the Basecamp was talking about some of the perks and other things they were getting rid of. I can see why. I can see how they look at that. Like, we want people to come here and be part of a high performing team, just like Netflix, just like Amazon. Amazon or Netflix doesn't do a bonus plan, or I don't know if they still don't, but in the past they never did because they realized that's a distraction. There's no need to have bonus plans. Pay them at a higher premium and tell them we're bringing you in because you're the best of the best. So I do believe that organizations need to be looked upon more as high-performing teams. That's what you're striving for and trying to get the best out of each and every one of us. And each and every one of us as employees, we're striving to be best version of ourselves. Does that answer the question? Is that
absolutely?
Is that
no. Okay. Makes sense. Yeah. It's great.
It's a tough one. I don't.
Yeah, no, I know. It is. Because it is an ongoing discussion. There is no, you know, resolution to this. There is no solution so far. I mean, out there, because there are companies who are struggling with, you know, managing these issues and having those discussions openly. But then again, that focus on mission goes away, and then companies like Basecamp, that what recently happened, Exodus that happened. People have been working there for 10, 12 years. They felt, you know, and they started quitting. So we'll evolve with time. And with Basecamp,
I think they handle it poorly. It sounds like way they read it. Like, I think Coinbase, you got to give credit where credit's due, where at least they took a side and they were like, enough.
True.
You may not agree with it, but I'm always advocating too that with every organization, whether you're a seed started startup or your established organization like Adobe, you're going to change. The organization is going to evolve just like humans do. We evolve every year. Every year we get older, we change, we look at things differently. That's the problem I think a lot of people struggle with today more than ever is how do you maintain culture? Culture is not static. It grows. It evolves every day. Every round of funding, we're going to be different and hopefully we're going to be better because of it. So I think that's there's an ideological misconception of how people view, I want the culture to stay the same. No, you don't. It won't work if it stays the same as Series A to a Series G.
True.
But I do think Coinbase, I may not agree with certain things of what they're doing, and I'm still kind of like, well, I can see what they're doing, but I also think they should create that safe environment where people can openly discuss things. But I do appreciate them drawing a line in the sand. I do appreciate what Shopify has done where, no, enough. And we need to kind of recalibrate everyone's mindsets to make them understand, hey, you come here for the mission, first and foremost. It's about Shopify first, everything else is second. And I always tell employees, if it's getting to a point where you're unhappy, come and talk to me and we can figure out next steps. There's going to be a point where we're all going to move on for various reasons, and that's okay.
Awesome. Any advice for young HR professionals?
Wow. I'm not young anymore, so I don't know if I'm the right guy.
They can learn from my experience.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. Yeah, I would say some of the stuff I learned along the way, work hard. And what I mean by that, it doesn't matter what school you went to. It doesn't matter your upbringing, what your zip code or postal code is. If you are able to work well with others, open your mind to others, and work extremely hard, you will find success. So that's definitely part one. And then part two is be hungry to learn and grow. I know it sounds like a typical slogan you see in a wall, but it really is important, especially if you're going to go after a startup. That's the other probably point three is they're hard. And I think that's a huge misconception in society today where a lot of students are coming out of universities thinking like, oh, look at Instagram or look at WhatsApp or look at this startup. You know, they got acquired. They you know, bought out billions. They're all rich. Working in a startup, as you know, demands a lot of sacrifice, a lot of hours, a lot of patience. You got to be okay with that. There's a lot of ambiguity. You got to be okay coming in and not having clear direction on a whole lot of things. Because at a startup, I always say to a lot of the managers and employees at Nihilus, a startup, one person does three jobs. Where an established organization, there's three people doing one job. And if you can, I know people at startups can relate to that. And if you are thinking about joining a startup, understand that the work will never end. There's never downtime. You got to be okay with that. And you also have to be motivated and passionate about doing it. No one's going to ask you to work 50, 60, 70, 90 hours. And there's times where a startup, that's how it functions. You have to be okay wanting to do that. That's what's going to define success for yourself and success for your team and success for the organization.
Awesome. Ryan, thank you so much for coming on this podcast. It was a lovely conversation. We got so many insights. I had a lot of fun.
I did too, Netzwerk. Thank you so much. It was an absolute honor.